We're in Acts chapter 14. We're in the middle of Paul and Barnabas's first missionary journey. They have already gone through Cyprus, where Paul had his first convert by the name of Sergius Paulus. And I suggested, I believe, does your commentary also suggest the same thing? I believe it does. Yeah. That's where Paul got his name, and I think it's right. I think that is exactly right. That Paul got his name, he's named himself after his first convert. I think that makes the most sense historically of why he would go from the name of the first king of Israel to the name known as Dwarfish. But it makes sense if he's trying to honor his first convert in Paphos on the island of Cyprus. Then they go up to Pisidian Antioch, and what happens in Pisidian Antioch? Nothing? Anything? He preaches? Right. Where does he preach?
In the synagogue.
Absolutely. And how did they respond? It was good initially, wasn't it? And then what happened? Right. Yeah. Then some of the Jews got jealous. They stir up some trouble for them and basically run them out of town. And what do they do at the end as a means of showing that they are leaving, but they're not happy about it? Shake the dust off their feet. Absolutely. I was talking to Cy Huffer after class, and he even mentioned that that he believes, and he's going to send me the reference. So if he doesn't send it to me, then this may not be true, but... but that in Jewish literature, that it was specifically an action that they would do toward Gentiles, which is possible. And if that is true, what in a sense is happening is, it's still connected to judgment, obviously. The Jews brushing off their dust towards the Gentiles, suggesting that judgment's going to befall you because you're dirty and no good. Well, it's ironic then that the apostles to the Gentiles do that to the Jews that have run them out of town. If that is true, I find that to be an interesting little tidbit. So thanks, Cy, for bringing that to my attention. But now we're in Acts chapter 14, verse 1, at Iconium. Now if you look on our handy-dandy little map here, we're up in Pisidian Antioch, and then we move over to Iconium. We started all the way over here in Seleucia. Well, Antioch, remember this is a different Antioch, Syrian Antioch. Pisidian Antioch, Syrian Antioch. They go to Seleucia, down to Salamis, over here to Paphos on the island of Cyprus. They go up here to Perga in the region of Pamphylia. And what happened in that region? What happened right here when they got here? John Mark left them. John Mark left them and goes all the way back down here to Jerusalem. They continue on, go up to Pisidian Antioch. Now they're moving over to Iconium. And today they'll go down to Lystra and Derbe as well. Iconium from Pisidian Antioch is about 90 miles east. So that would have taken a good 3 days or so to get there if they were trucking about 25 miles or more a day. Which, you know, give them 4 days. We'll just say four. All right, so at Iconium, Paul and Barnabas went as usual into the Jewish synagogue. What do you notice about that? What's Luke indicating? Yeah, what's he indicating? Yeah, he's trying to say, this is a pattern. Now, technically, this is only the third time that they've begun their mission at the synagogue. But he's using the words as usual to point out this is a pattern that you're going to see. This is the way they do their thing. They start at the synagogues and they move out from there. As usual, into the Jewish synagogue. There they spoke so effectively that a great number of Jews and Gentiles believed. What do you think they talked about? Probably the resurrection. What else? Absolutely. That's one of the key elements. There's three of them. Three key elements we've seen in every speech so far, every sermon so far. The history of Israel. And what was the third one? Kind of. Think of the three-part sermon we had last time. Old Testament references to prove the first two. The history of Israel, which points to Jesus. Jesus, ultimately, the moment of Jesus' climax is in his crucifixion and the resurrection. And then ultimately, he said, now let's talk about the Old Testament, how this has been talking about the whole time. So we don't get the sermon. We don't even get the sermon that converted tons of people here in Iconium. But we probably know what he said anyway. Because we've already seen it. Every single sermon had those three elements. The history, the resurrection, goodness, don't forget the resurrection, Shane, and the Old Testament references that show that this is the way that God had it planned from the beginning. But the Jews who refused to believe stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their mind against the brothers. We've seen this pattern as well, haven't we? They go into the synagogue and they preach, using probably the same sermon they've been preaching so far every time they've preached. Then we have a great number of people believe, and then it's usually followed up by persecution that's stirred up by the Jews that get jealous and upset. And they poisoned the minds against their brothers. So Paul and Barnabas spent considerable time there speaking boldly for the Lord, who confirmed the message of His grace by enabling them to do miraculous signs and wonders. What's the purpose of miracles? To validate the message. That's exactly what Luke says right there, doesn't it? He says not only were they speaking boldly, but they were doing these miraculous things, these miraculous powers, as a means to show what they were saying was legitimate. Miracles are not magic tricks. It's not some cool cosmic little trick that you get to do every once in a while if you get your, you know, faith juices up high enough. You know, that's the way we treat it. It's the deeds that validate the words that are so outlandish that if something miraculous isn't shown, people will end up killing them because they're blaspheming. Maybe something so outlandish as saying Jesus was the incarnated God that hung on a tree and rose from the dead. You're going to have to prove that some way. All right, let me heal someone. You know, it's the way they work. Verse 4, the people of the city were divided. Now they're divided. Initially, we were overwhelmingly amount of people coming. Now they're divided because of the Jews stirring them up. Some sided with the Jews. Others plotted with the apostles. Wait a minute. How do we define the word apostles?
Messengers.
Messengers, exactly. Are there capital A apostles as far as the disciples? Sure. But it doesn't mean that there aren't other people that are sent with a message to preach the word. I was talking to somebody the other day. We actually have evidence of a woman in the second century being referred to as the name apostle, sent with a message to speak. Sorry, don't know how that fits in your paradigm, but history's history. Maybe your paradigm needs to shift. Oh, how silly. We'll just ignore it and act like that doesn't happen. Oh, okay. And keep your paradigm. There was a plot afoot among the Gentiles and Jews, together with their leaders, to mistreat them and stone them. Huh. Isn't that ironic? Is there something ironic about this at all? Anybody can think of anything ironic about this? No? Yeah, huh. When they come to stone Paul, in just a minute, you have to think that the moment of Stephen in the Sanhedrin was going through Paul's mind. Where he's looking at the eyes running towards him, and he actually can sit there and say, that's the way I looked. Now I see the anger in their eyes that I had in my eyes whenever I was leading the charge of stoning Stephen. And there's something about this moment that must really root down deep in Paul's heart where he says, now I'm worthy to preach the gospel. For some of the things that I had done, now being done to me, in a sense, probably made him feel better. Whenever Paul went to heaven, who do you think the first person was that he sought out? Somebody would say, Jesus, probably, maybe. I know where I'd want to go, though. I'd be like, Jesus, man, I want to spend all eternity with you, but I got to find Stephen. Got to find Stephen. So, man, I wasn't able to forgive myself down there for what I did to Stephen. I got to talk to him now. Of course, Stephen's over in the corner going, dude, it's cool. It's cool. And Paul's going, no, it's not. I know what the anger looked like because it happened to me too, and I'm sorry. There's a lot of people that I want to see whenever I get to heaven so I can say similar things, you know what I mean? Just pray that God's bigger than my idiocy with a lot of those people. But they found out about it, and they fled to the Lycaonian cities of Lystra and Derbe, into the surrounding country where they continued to preach the good news. Lystra and Derbe, we're going about 20 miles now, 20 miles to the southeast. In Lystra, there sat a man crippled in his feet who was lame from birth and had never walked. Does this sound familiar? Use your in what chapter skills to remind me. What? Chapter 3, exactly. When Peter and John, remember the song, Peter and John went to pray, they met a lame man. Chapter 3. Peter and John, they go, they find a lame man by the gate named Beautiful, where they keep the outcasts and the ugly things of society. And they look at him and he says, hey, will you give us some money? And they stare at him intently, the text says. Same word's going to be used here in just a minute. They stare at him intently. A man crippled from birth. And he says, you know what? Silver and gold I don't have, but I can give you something better. I can give you Jesus. I can give you your whole life back by healing you. Actually, give you not just a whole life back, but give you a life you never had before. You'll be able to actually provide for a family. You'll be able to actually go and work, and you'll enjoy it because you'll have the legs to do it. Similar thing happening here with Paul and Barnabas. Parallels are not on accident because ultimately they parallel back to Jesus as well. In Lystra, there sat a man crippled in his feet who was lame from birth and had never walked. He listened to Paul as he was speaking. Paul looked directly at him, stared at him intently, looked directly at him, saw that he had faith to be healed, and called out, "Stand up on your feet." At that, the man jumped up and began to walk. When the crowd saw what Paul had done, they shouted in the Lyconian language, "The gods have come down to us in human form." Why is it important that he brings out the detail that they spoke in the Lyconian language? Why is that an important detail?
They don't understand.
Yeah, because in a minute we're going to move into confusion. When Paul and Barnabas were going, "What's happening? What's happening? I don't understand what's happening." And the reason why they don't know what's happening is because they're speaking in a dialect they're not familiar with. Now, Paul and his companions would have actually known quite a few languages. It's honestly one of the things that frustrates me most about the education system in America is that we usually only come out of it knowing one language. And 98% of the rest of the world doesn't have that same experience. You go anywhere, and they can usually speak more than one language. Anywhere. Even some of the places that are the most uneducated places can carry on a broken conversation with you in English. It's one of the things that is just, to me, it's just travesty. In the ancient world, it was especially that way as well. Paul himself probably could have spoken Aramaic, Hebrew, probably also, well, definitely Greek, and maybe even Latin. I'm not talking dialects, I'm just talking major languages. More likely, he could speak all of those. Now, the Lyconian language, though, there'd be no advantage to knowing that language unless you're in Lyconia. Right? Unless you're in the Lystra or in Derbe. There'd be no reason to know that language. Because it's such a specific dialect that it really would only be helpful in that region, not across the world. So even though they have people that are multi-language, can speak multiple different languages in multiple different places, the Lyconian language is one that they don't get. Although, whenever we hear it translated, they probably were wanting to know what they said immediately. Because what happens next, it gets crazy. "The gods have come down to us in human form. Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul they called Hermes," because he was the chief speaker. How does that make sense? If Paul is the leader, how come he's not Zeus? Exactly. Yeah, because Hermes was the messenger of the gods. Hermes was the messenger of the gods. Matter of fact, Hermes was quite a wily little guy. He would go and he would give the message of the gods, but he would say it in such a way that was ambiguous that people would misinterpret it. And he would say something like, you know, a king's wondering whether or not he's going to win a war. And Hermes would come and he would say, "Death will be found on this day that will lead to great jubilation." And the king's like, "Awesome! Great jubilation is going to happen because they're going to die. We're going to be doing great." Well, he didn't say who was going to die and who was going to be jubilating, did he? And then he watches it play out and he watches the surprise on the king's face whenever the king has a sword run through him. And Hermes is in the corner laughing. Because ultimately when it came to Hermes, he not just was the messenger of the king, but you had to interpret his messages because they could have some ambiguities that you need to get past. Which is one of the reasons why we get the word, or we have the class here known as hermeneutics. Right? I'm spelling it wrong probably, but you get the point. That's not right. Doesn't matter. Hermeneutics. Right? Now, the whole point is this first part. Hermes. It is the interpretation, the principles of interpretation of how to understand different phrases. Hermeneutics. That's Hermes. He was the speaker. He was the messenger. And Paul is the one up preaching. Therefore, even though he is the leader, according to what has happened in the past chapter and a half, because Barnabas wasn't speaking, they would look at Barnabas as the chief god, Zeus. Now, why would they name them Zeus and Hermes? Why would they immediately go there? Well, it actually is connected to the history of the city of Lystra. So the story goes, or you can even say once upon a time, or whatever genre you want to enter us into in myth. Once upon a time, Zeus and Hermes, they came to the city of Lystra to test their benevolence, to test their hospitality. And so they disguise themselves as beggars, and they go door to door, and they knock on every single door asking for them if they could come in and they would be helped. And it goes, as the story goes, every single door they went to, and no one let the beggars in. No one, everybody refused to help them. Until they came to the very last home in the whole town. It was the home of a poor elderly couple by the name of Philemon and Baucis. They were very poor. They had really nothing to offer them except for their pet goose. And so they are going around. They're chasing the pet goose, trying to get it so they could kill it and eat it. And it's so fast that these older couples, you know, you can see them kind of gingerly running around, you know. Come here, goose, whatever. I don't know what they would have named him. Come here, Hermes. I don't know, you know, hermeneutics. It was spelled incorrectly. I don't know what they named him, but they're trying to chase him. And finally, in the moment that they're chasing, Zeus and Hermes show themselves to the people. And they look at the people and they say, because you showed benevolence and hospitality, we'll give you anything you want. And they said, all we want is to die together, serving as priests in a temple dedicated to you two. And they're like, fine. So he took their hut and he transformed it into the temple of Zeus and Hermes inside of their city. And they destroyed the rest of the city. Why? Because the people were not hospitable to the gods that had come to their city. And now, in this moment, they see this miraculous power. And they're sitting there going, oh my goodness. Oh my goodness, we're being tested again. We're not failing this time. Oh, it's Zeus and it's Hermes. And they start worshiping. They start freaking out. They're like, not only will we be hospitable, we're going to start offering sacrifices to you. We're going to do whatever it takes for you not to wipe us all out again. We've learned our lesson. You see what's happening? So that's what's behind their vision here. And that's why what happens next makes more sense. The priest of Zeus, whose temple, the former house of Philemon and Baucis, whose temple was just outside the city, brought bulls and wreaths to the city gates because he and the crowd wanted to offer sacrifices to them. We're not going to fall into the same mistake. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of this, they tore their clothes and rushed out into the crowd shouting, because remember, they didn't understand the language. They didn't know what was happening. And now what's being told, the kosher Jews, kind of kosher, some Jews wouldn't think they're very kosher at this point, I mean, you're pronouncing the gospel to Gentiles, are going to be worshipped. And their monotheism, you know, red lights are freaking out. Don't worship us, worship God alone. So they go, they rend their clothes, they rush out in the middle of the crowd. Verse 15, men, why are you doing this? We too are only men, human like you. Yeah, right, Hermes. I'm not falling for that. You've done this before. No, we're only human. Mm-mm. Here's your bowl, you know. We too are only men, human like you. We are bringing you good news, Evangelion, telling you to turn from these worthless things to the living God who made heaven and earth and sea and everything in them. In the past, he let all nations go their own way. Yet he has not left himself without testimony. He has shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your hearts with joy. Even with these words, they had difficulty keeping the crowd from sacrificing to them. They're like, okay, light the fire. Like, they're like, we're not falling for this trick. You know? If in your history you had that same story, you'd probably be reacting the same way. We're not being judged again. I don't care what they say. They're getting a worship service, and that's just the way it's going to be. Verse 19, then some Jews came from Antioch and Iconium and won the crowd over. Do you notice something that's happening right now? What is happening? That phrase right there, what does that clue you into? What is one of the key things that's occurring right now in their ministry? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, that is definitely one thing that you can observe. Yeah, they have people that are not fans. What else? That's good. That gets to it. What else?
A lot of honor is being ascribed to them.
A lot of honor, yeah, is being given, acquired by Paul and Barnabas, and that's not making the Jews very happy. Yeah.
Didn't this kind of happen to Paul, Peter, John?
How so? I'm not disagreeing. Not that doesn't happen to Peter and John. No, this one's pretty unique. But what is similar is the people that are pursuing them in the same way that they pursued all the other Jews, all the other apostles. Absolutely. Yeah.
I was gonna say it looks like again, Paul is experiencing what he dished out.
Yeah. Absolutely. What the ministry that is following Paul and Barnabas right now of the Jews is the ministry that Paul created and was the head leader for when he was on his way down to Damascus. Right? Following wherever Christians are going, rooting them out, persecuting them, dragging them, arresting them, causing problems for them. And that same ministry that Paul's like, I wrote the book on this ministry, is now being used against him. Because, boy, they're following him everywhere. They're even now out in Lystra, out in Iconium, in some of these more country regions, outside of the rural area, or outside of the urban areas. Going all the way out to Lystra. We're going to follow you, no matter where you go. We're going to destroy you. Here comes the awesomeness of Paul. Then some Jews came from Antioch and Iconium and won the crowd over. They stoned Paul and dragged him outside the city, thinking he was dead. They killed him, so they thought, and threw him outside the city. Some people say, is this a resurrection or is it not? I have no indication that it's a resurrection, because it says they thought he was dead. But after the disciples had gathered around him, possibly resurrecting him, I don't know, he got up and went back into the city. Just let that sink in for a minute. He gets stoned, killed. They're like, he's dead. Drag him outside the city. They throw him out for dead. All the disciples come around him, and all of a sudden Paul's like, oh, I'm back. I'm back. So where do you want to go, Paul? We want to run down to Derby? Where do we want to go? Let's go right back in. Why? I'm not done preaching. They interrupted my sermon. I'm not done. So he gets back up and goes right in. Says, the next day, he and Barnabas left for Derbe. So not only is he stoned, he goes right back in the city. Then the next day, they're going to travel another 15, 20 miles. Here's a lesson you can learn from Paul's life. Make sure you really have something to complain about before you complain. You know what I mean? It was so ironic that I was teaching on this one this morning because, man, I woke up this morning and my head was pounding and it's like, you know, whatever, like 5 in the morning and I'm just like, Lord, I can't do this. I'm too tired. I don't want to get up. I'm exhausted. I have nothing left in me. It's like, you're going to have to do this. And then I get to my office, I'm starting to prep for my classes and I was like, oh, man. Was I stoned yesterday? Yeah, not the marijuana way. Some of you are like, were you in your class yesterday? You were a bit loopy. Seriously though, do I really have anything to complain about whenever I just have to wake up in my comfortable bed at 5 in the morning to prepare myself for the weekend whenever I get a day and a half of Sabbath? Really? That's what I'm going to complain about? Come on. Sometimes we convince ourselves that we can justify our selfishness by the how much our schedules are really packed. And so we justify our selfishness by just everything just points back to us. There's several things you can learn from Paul in this moment. Number one, you probably don't have as much to complain about as what you think you do. Because unless you were beaten by rocks, I really don't want to hear too much complaining. Number two, don't get into a contest of comparing your schedule with someone else. I promise you, none of you want to lay your schedule up against Mark Moore's. I promise you. Because as much work as you think that the professors are giving you, I promise you they're doing 10 times as much behind the scenes. I promise. I'm learning that more and more this semester. Man, you don't want to put your schedule up against somebody like Mark Moore or somebody like Larry Pichauer. Just don't do that. Number three, know that every time you're talking to someone, there's more going on behind the scenes than what's really happening right there. I understand whenever you guys are talking to me about your different projects and different things you're struggling to get done, that you've got a life outside of this. I get it. It's one of the reasons why I want you to come and talk to me about it. I want to hurt with you. I want to help you. But don't think just because you have a bad interaction with somebody, it's just because that person's a jerk. Just because that person's not as holy as you are. You don't know what they're going through. You don't know if the night before one of their family members has died. You don't know if the night before maybe they were even raped at something down the street. You don't know what's going on in their life. So don't think that you can judge some person or say that they're a jerk and just run their name through the mud off of one interaction. You don't know if in that moment that person's gallbladder is exploding out of their stomach and they're just trying to hold it all in while they talk to you. See that look she gave me? Do you even know what's going on in her life? Don't judge them by a look. Maybe they were beaten by rocks the day before and they're just hiding it really well. So honestly, I want to hear what is burdening you. But keep it in perspective. Because if you don't, you're just going to destroy community. It doesn't help anyone. Don't be so selfish to think that just the things that you're going through, no one else is going through anything even close to that. Man, you are worth so much. You are so significant. But don't ever think you're as insignificant as you think you are or as significant as you think you are. It's somewhere in between. Make sure we're complaining about the right things. Not about waking up at a 7 or an 8 o'clock class. That's the most you have to complain about. You're doing okay. All right? Man, I got to write a 10-page paper. Okay. You know, I know a guy that just preached a message a couple weeks ago with the gun pointed at him. You got it pretty good. Okay? They preach the good news, euangelion. We're going to keep talking about euangelion. They preach the good news in that city and won a large number of disciples. What city? Derbe. They've moved to Derbe. Then they returned to Lystra. He can't get enough. His persistence in Lystra actually does pay off, because do you know who is one of the key converts from Lystra? We have two books that's named after him that Paul wrote. Timothy. Timothy's from Lystra. One of the most valued companions, one of the most valued people in Paul's ministry to him. One of his sons in the faith. Converts because Paul, even stoning, couldn't keep him away from the city of Lystra. Goes back for more. Then they returned to Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch, strengthening the disciples and encouraging them to remain true to the faith. We must go through many hardships to enter the kingdom of God, they said. Paul and Barnabas appointed elders for them in each church, and with prayer and fasting committed them, to the Lord, in whom they had put their trust. After going through Pisidia, they came into Pamphylia, and when they had preached the word in Perga, they went down to Attalia. Now notice what they're doing. Right now what they're doing is they're retracing their steps. So notice the way in which the missionary journey goes. You get here, and then you start going backwards to the same place you've already been. This time, though, they go to Perga, and they hop over to Attalia before they move on. So they're going back and making sure that what they planted is now being watered and making sure the people are being strengthened. Which is smart, because ultimately there's going to be, if there's Jews pursuing them from city to city, there will be Jews that will stay back and try to pick off all the people that have decided to switch their allegiance to Jesus. So they're going back and making sure that their work hasn't been done in vain. They hop over to Attalia. From Attalia, they sailed back to Antioch. Which Antioch? Syrian Antioch. Not Pisidian Antioch. Syrian Antioch. Where they had been committed to the grace of God for the work they had now completed. On arriving there, they gathered the church together and reported all that God had done through them and how He had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles. And they stayed there a long time with the disciples. That's the end of the first missionary journey. Why? Because we begin the missionary journeys by when they leave Antioch, and we measure when they end by once they get back to Antioch. And what is the first missionary journey's focus on? Expanding the gospel, the good news, to the Gentiles, the ends of the earth. And will it come with beating and hardships? Yeah, but Paul looks at everybody and he says, we've got to endure hardships for the kingdom. Why? Because it's worth that much. And you'll endure hardships for the kingdom too. Hopefully not self-inflicted, because those are just unnecessary. But hopefully because Satan sees you so much as a threat, he's got to do something. He can't just sit back and let you run wild. Love you guys. See you on Tuesday. And oh yeah, by the way, we're officially caught up. That's right. Mark it down. 1 minute to spare. How do you like that?